Although America.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Joseph Cotto, and let me tell you about an epic story of victory, defeat, friendship, betrayal, heroism, cowardice, deep respect, blind hatred, and above all else, the struggle for survival. It is my new book, Runaway Masters, a true story of slavery, freedom, triumph, and tragedy, beyond 1619 and 1776. Check it out on Amazon by following the link below. The paperback is $9.99 US, while the Kindle version is $4.99. If you are a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, you will be able to read it for free. Hope that you enjoy the book. I hope everyone is able to hear me tonight. Paul and my computer are having audio issues again, but he's coming in through telephone now. So I hope everybody in the audience is able to hear me. Please let me know if you're not able to hear me, because I will try to find a way to remedy the situation as soon as possible. But I think everything is okay. I was actually using this headset and microphone in this computer earlier, so there should be no problem. I think, as a matter of fact, my audio quality might have even improved since I got this thing. Certainly, it's a notch above what you would typically hear from me. Anyway, though, I will say this cannot go on as long as some other episodes have. Paul has a commitment later on this evening. So please, if you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, do leave it via Streamlabs and leave it as soon as you can. Thank you very much in advance. I shall throw the link into the live chat if I could find the link, of course. That's the $64,000 question, and I have it. Here's the link. It's going into the live chat. Paul, how's it going?
Fine. I continue to progress on the road to recovery from my horrendous accident.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that you're recovering, needless to say. Mm-hmm. It was a terrible, terrible thing which happened to you. And mm-hmm. We're all just lucky to see that you're alive.
Well, so am I. I'm lucky to see that I'm alive.
No question about it. It's been a crazy few months, needless to say. Now, of course, people, as long as it's reasonable, responsible, bring stuff up for us to discuss. But there is something very interesting which has come about as something of a revelation from Pedro Gonzalez, who works for Chronicles Magazine, and he also writes for American Greatness, if I have that combination correct. He recently did a story about this affair, which Kristi Noem is purportedly having with Corey Lewandowski, who was obviously a big fixture in what's called Trump world, but now he's been sort of excised from it, as I understand it. Apparently, this is the allegation. He did something inappropriately on a sexual basis with a female donor, and she got very angry about that, and so that's what occasioned this. But Kristi Noem's camp has said that they severed ties with him as well. They said that after the article from Pedro came out, and that was published once again, in case I didn't mention before, in American Greatness. Paul, anything to say about anything that's happened here?
Yeah, I think that this is a story that continues to break. Mm-hmm. And you know, I would emphasize the fact that it came out in American Greatness, not in Chronicles. Mm-hmm. Although I think Pedro has, you know, other secrets that he will reveal in Chronicles later on. It is hard for me personally to believe that a woman as attractive as Kristi Noem, who's married to somebody who looks better than Lewandowski, would be having an affair with this man who strikes me as an utter boor. I think that the Trump people are well rid of him. I think if the story is true, and the story does seem to have legs, then we have to say that Noem has deplorably bad taste in men, at least in this case.
Yes, indeed. Obviously, I cannot comment as to the veracity of the claims, but I can say that if it is true, I co-sign what Paul just said. It would be very, strange. Pedro is obviously not a gnome fan, and I'm not a big fan of Christy gnomes either, although Pedro takes it to a different level than I do for sure. But all the same, people who are gnome defenders who view her as a potential 2024 GOP nominee, which I think is ridiculous, or they view her as, you know, some sort of, I think this is much more likely, a cabinet pick and a potential, Trump administration. They say Pedro dislikes Gnome, so this is, you know, X, Y, and Z. It's not true. I don't buy that argument, even though Pedro and I obviously have had our differences. I certainly don't think he's making this stuff up. I don't know if all of his sources, though, are being totally honest with him, but they very well could be. But I certainly, even though I've had my differences with Pedro, I certainly don't think that he's manufactured this claim, as some have alleged.
No, I mean, it is coming from various sources. Now, it's hard to authenticate these sources. I mean, obviously, because you're not going to get, you know, people to say, come out in front and say, you know, I said this or that, particularly if they're involved in the South Dakota administration, the state administration. They now don't want to expose themselves. But it's the kind of story that's coming from so many places that you have to lend it at least some credence, I would think. I think one of the directions in which Pedro's journalism goes is to show that people around Trump, or, you know, whom the Trump organization, you know, has glorified, are really not people that an America First campaign would want to have on board. And he's been very good at exposing the defects of these people. My own response to Pedro, who I suppose is under me within this this Chinese hierarchy, which I'm at the top, at least technically, the CEO Devin Foley is above me, I suppose, within this Chinese hierarchy, but I'm somewhere above Pedro. It would seem to me that and this is something Pedro obviously knows, that Trump is not a deeply principled person. I mean, he is the symbol of a movement, you know, and he has, you know, personified some of the qualities one might see of the populist right at various times. He certainly stood up to the media, though not always effectively. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to expect him to surround himself with principled members of the right or something like that is to expect much too much from this man. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, certainly Trump is a pragmatist at heart. He is not someone who has deep ideological convictions of any kind. I think he fundamentally likes solving problems and doing so in a way that boosts his public appeal. Mm-hmm, and I think he just enjoys doing this for the same reason that some enjoy playing chess games or doing puzzles, because it's just his hobby of solving these big problems in business or in politics. And Trump himself, as Keith Preston said, and I agree, is really very similar to, or basically, a Rockefeller Republican who has been presented in this political age of ours, in which Nelson Rockefeller himself would have been regarded as a fascist. So people consider Trump's very non-ideological form of conservatism, if you can even call what he presents conservatism, people call it all sorts of crazy stuff, when in reality, Trump is a Rockefeller Republican.
Yeah, I would agree. In some ways, he's sort of like a conventional Republican who leans left, actually, on some social issues, like gay marriage. Yes, yes, no problem with that. He did have a conversion on the abortion question, but one has to wonder how genuine it is. He became willy-nilly the leader of an ideological movement, but he seems to be, you know, in some ways, I would agree, thoroughly non-ideological, and probably sees himself basically as a problem solver. But, you know, he is, one might say, sort of trapped in his position because, you know, since he has become the leader of the populist right at the national level, he is the leader of the populist right at the national level. Some of us expect him to take the role seriously. And I think, you know, most of his appointments do not show that he's a leader of the populist right. I mean, I'm sort of hard pressed to see in what way Nikki Haley, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, a whole bunch of his appointments have to do. And even this America First policy committee he's putting together, I think, as Pedro has shown or is showing, and I think an article that he's working on now. These are not people with any track record of being anything other than rather conventional Republicans, or just sort of Washington Foundation types like Stephen Moore. So he has been critical of these people, and I think justifiably so. But then the question always comes up: Are we expecting more from Trump, you know, than Trump is capable of giving us, at least on the ideological front?
Yeah, or even more than he said he would deliver. Because if you look at Trump's campaign promises, he made very specific issue-based promises. Of course, he did use rhetoric like, I will save the country, but it was within the context of these issues that he was campaigning on. And if one looks at these issues, it really boils down to somebody who wants to solve problems, not somebody who's presenting some sort of banner for an ideological movement. I think it just happened to be that Trump was the only one talking outside of the GOP establishment in 2015, 2016. And so he just sort of fell into this populist rightist thing. When his campaign started out, basically, is that of a Rockefeller Republican who was very anti-PC, which does not necessarily mean that one is any sort of principled right-wing ideologue or movement leader by his nature.
Yeah, I think this is true. He sort of starts out almost as a kind of centrist Republican, and he does feel strongly on certain issues like trade, the situation of the American working class,
immigration and political correctness too.
Yeah, sort of, because he does buy into a lot of this himself, like gay marriage and the gay stuff he seems to buy into. So he's sort of selectively against it. He's against it if they hit out at him. I mean, I think a lot of it is ego driven, and if the politically correct groups, the National Organization of Women, come against him, then he gets very angry. You know, and is going to fire back. But, you know, it is not a kind of, what do I want to say, a kind of well-structured argument that he's making against him. His statements are generally emotional. They don't seem well thought out. But there are sort of sound bites there that the populist right and the moral right, or the moral majority, whatever we call them today, are able to use.
No question about that. As far as Kristi Noem goes, and by the way, Paul and I will be getting a Streamlabs pretty soon, so if you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please leave it via Streamlabs as soon as possible. Thank you very much in advance. Like I said, the show's not going to be as long as some others have been tonight. Pardon me. But looking at Kristi Noem, some people look to her as opposed to Trump as a more principled right-wing presence in the GOP. Obviously, Pedro disagrees with that. I would say that, or at least principled pseudo-populist right-wing presence in the GOP, and Pedro obviously disagrees with categorizing Noem as such. I think that Kristi Noem sort of represents like a throwback to Reaganism, really. If I had to say what she represents, I think that would be it more than anything else. I don't think Kristi Noem brings much to the table that's not already there in the GOP. I certainly don't think she'd be more effective than Trump as a presidential candidate or somebody to galvanize the GOP base to turn out in midterms. I don't dislike Kristi Noem personally. I do think that she did something very underhanded, though, when marijuana was legalized via referendum in her state, and she pursued some really left-wing like judicial activist path against it by going judge shopping and getting it struck down, even though marijuana was more popular than she is. So that doesn't suggest something good about her. But all the same, I don't, you know, have any sort of hatred for her. But I don't see her as being a very effective leader for the GOP, and I don't imagine she would fare particularly well in a presidential election. Paul, anything to say about anything that I brought up?
Yeah, I think the reason she went against marijuana is she has taken a very, very leftist stand on things like transgendered athletes.
Yes, she has.
Pedro would argue that it really has something to do with her funding or where she's getting campaign funds from. And the same thing might apply to Abbott. I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. Certainly it would. And then it also applies to this governor in Arkansas, doesn't it?
Oh, I mean, yeah. Who,
who seems to be entirely allied to the transgendered athlete competition crowd.
Asa Hutchinson.
Hutchinson, yeah. Mm-hmm. So she has taken some really weird positions, Noam. Mm-hmm. In some ways, you know, similar to those of Hutchinson. While at the same time, you know, striking out against marijuana. I think she's anti-abortion. She has sort of waffled, from what Pedro tells me, on closing up the state because of COVID. She seems to lean in one direction and go the other direction. She doesn't seem to be a particularly decisive person. When I've heard her interviewed, I find her extremely unimpressive. She's a very pretty woman, I have to say, but and she's 49, you know, and she's still highly attractive. Mm-hmm. But I just, you know, and she has a nice voice, but I just don't see any substance in her or find any substance in her.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's interesting, I suppose, with her and the marijuana thing, because it was very unpopular what she did. I think the only reason for it, unless it's some deep ideological conviction, which I doubt that it is, it would be because somebody bankrolling her candidacy really doesn't want marijuana passed.
No, I think it might be part of a balancing act, since she's moved left on other things, you know, that she decides to move right on the marijuana issue.
Well, it also should be noted that the pharmaceutical industry is very anti-marijuana legalization, not because they care about, you know, people using marijuana, the effects of it on society, but because they think that correctly, that marijuana-based products are a big competitor mm-hmm. for their, you know, traditional pharmaceuticals. And, you know, a lot of people would say that the marijuana is much less dangerous for you than these pharmaceuticals are, which even though you can get them with a prescription, they have all these side effects, like you could die when you wake up in the morning of a heart attack, your hair might fall out, maybe you'll be impotent for the rest of your life. So, you know, I can certainly see why the pharmaceutical lobby would be pressuring her to do this, but the balancing act could apply as well. I think it probably some combination of the two. I will just say, as far as Noam goes on the question of transgenderism, she was a very ardent opponent of the transgender lobby and movement and this and that. But then when it came down to it, she backtracked and she decided mm-hmm. not to go through with the law, which the legislature passed, which she supported.
Right.
And she made up some BS excuse. And I'm sure that was because her donors pressured mm-hmm. her to do so.
No, I think you might be right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sort of zigzagging suggests donor pressure. And she does a lot of zigzagging. You know, mm-hmm. The more you look at her career in South Dakota, the general image of her, you know, the one that she's tried to maintain is that she is, you know, some kind of ideological conservative. And she does get beaten up on at CNN and MSNBC, all of which is to her advantage because, you know, it allows her to preserve a conservative image even while she plays these, you know, this footsie with, you know, with leftist donors. Mm.
Yes, no question about that. So we'll see what happens with her. But I don't find her to be a very impressive politician, although I don't hate her either. I will say this. She does play the woman card a lot. She says that, you know, people are criticizing her because they don't like a strong woman or a strong conservative woman. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's a very good idea. It's sort of hackish. It's very desperate, I think. I certainly don't think that people are opposing her because she's a woman. Anything to say about that before we move on?
Paul? Yeah, I think it's true. You know, women who are on the right get beaten up in the most sexist way by the leftist media. It happens all the time. Mm-hmm. It happened to Michelle Bachmann. It certainly happened to Sarah Palin, who obviously was no whiz kid. But, the left took liberties with her that they would never take with, you know, somebody with whom they're in political agreement. Mm-hmm. It's tiresome listening to this after a while. But I think there is certainly substance in the charge, and there's also a dual standard, you know, which we see. So, but then you can only go so far saying this, you know, that I'm a strong woman and they don't like me because I'm too strong or something like that.
I was going to say she actually made that charge against her critics on the right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was, she wasn't talking to people on the left, although she might've been at some point, but not from what I heard. So I just thought it was really, sort of predictable, boring
right.
victimhood politics that she was engaged in. But I do agree that on the left, there is a huge double standard as to what's acceptable for criticizing women on the right in relation to the left. Mm-hmm. Certainly people on the right get dragged out, and women on the right get dragged out and treated in some really nasty ways. All right. On another note, getting to Streamlabs. Once again, folks, if you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment from Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs. We won't be on as long as we have been on some other episodes, so getting your stuff in as soon as possible is of the utmost importance. The link is in the live chat. Get your stuff in fast. Thank you very much in advance. From Blog of the West, and this one is for me, Joseph Cotto. I'm curious about your reflections on your previous First Amendment auditor guests. Might you now lump them in with sovereign citizens? What for you is the ultimate value of First Amendment auditors? And I'm naturally also quite curious about Paul Gottfried's thoughts here. Well, we've had one First Amendment auditor guest on the program, Rogue Nation, as his moniker goes. He wrote First Amendment auditors go around using cameras to essentially test to see whether or not people are going to allow them to record in places where these auditors think they're allowed to record. I think that there's a very valuable aspect of this. Some auditors take things very far, and they get intentionally antagonistic, and they do so to get clicks, which translates into money for them. Rogue Nation is certainly one of the more principled, intelligent, and less incendiary auditors out there. I would be very glad to have him back on the show, in fact. So that's the situation there. But no, I would not lump all First Amendment auditors in with sovereign citizens, unless they actually are sovereign citizens themselves, unless they are members of that sovereign citizen movement, then I wouldn't say they're sovereign citizens at all. Certainly Rogue Nation is not a sovereign citizen. So I think that the First Amendment auditors do have a value in terms of protecting freedom of expression, which I'm very big on. But some of them do abuse this. Some of them think they know the law and they don't, and they get themselves into problems. And there are some who are actually sovereign citizens, and obviously I don't support that at all. Paul, anything to say about what Blog of the West brought up?
Yeah, I'm not really privy to this conversation. I assume you mean groups that snoop on others, like Project Veritas or something like that.
No, the sovereign citizens just go around to public places with cameras, and they record, and they see if people will arrest them for recording in a situation where they believe they're legally allowed to record.
Yeah, so are you asking me whether I approve of such action or not?
Blog of the West wanted your thoughts on what he asked me about the First Amendment auditors.
Yeah, now the First Amendment auditors would be people who would say they have a right to record these conversations.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, even if the people are being recorded would not want the remarks to be recorded.
Exactly correct.
I suppose they could claim some kind of constitutional right to do so. I generally don't find their actions particularly admirable. Mm. You know, I don't see them. I see them as people trying to advance their own interest or their own political agenda, rather than people, you know, who are standing up for the absolute quality of the First Amendment or testing the limits of the First Amendment. There looks to be some kind of, you know, there's usually some kind of self-interest or quest for payback that I see here.
And from Dr. Bob, in 376, the Goths arrived at the Danube River as refugees and petitioned Emperor Valens to be led into the empire. Valens was later killed at the Battle of Adrianople, from which Rome never recovered. Mm-hmm. Are we headed for a Battle of Adrianople moment? I don't think Dr. Bob's talking about a literal battle, but I think he's referring to is what he said, a moment in which America, or perhaps the West moreover, reaches a stage where it can never go back to what it once was. I would say very clearly that this is on the horizon, and either it has come, we're just going through different phases of it, or it is coming and it's unavoidable. Paul, anything to say about what Dr. Bob brought up?
Yeah, but remember that victory at Adrianople is won in 378. It takes them many years before they reach Rome and sack it in 410, right? So people traveled slowly back then. And what you had is a kind of, you know, slow motion history. I think sort of dramatic. Things are not happening in quite the same way. Now, we're not being invaded. Our cities are not going to be sacked by foreign invaders yet. But it seems to me that we have turned a corner in a way that I consider unfortunate. There's no way of going back, as far as I can see. One of the great losses, I think, are constitutional liberties, or liberalism itself, liberalism in the sense in which I defended in my book After Liberalism, that is, liberalism as it existed back in the 19th century and among the founders of America. We talk about, you know, people should have First Amendment freedom of speech or something. This, of course, is not going to come back. The left is going to totally destroy this. And the left is in the same power position that we find them here in just about every Western liberal democracy. It's the same everywhere. It's no better in Canada. It's worse in Germany, worse in Sweden. It's not very good in Spain. England is pretty much the same as the United States, maybe slightly worse, I would think, although I could be wrong. But it's, you know, we're looking at, one might say, the rapid disappearance of liberalism, together with the destruction or self-destruction of all the institutions that define Western civilization before liberalism. And I really see the woke left, which is taking power in alliance with the modern administrative state, with corporate capitalists, and with by now the all-powerful woke left media, I see these groups that are taking power as being totally destructive, destructive of freedom, destructive of human dignity. And I really don't, I think their power is not going to last, but whatever is able to defeat them will not bring us back to the way we were before this left emerged as the most powerful force.
A very, very high quality question, by the way, from Dr. Yes. Bob. Ezra's blog of the West, of course, but the historical perspective that Dr. Bob brings here is very much worthwhile. Also from Dr. Bob, a second question. I am in an irascible mood tonight. I hear the right virtually idolize Ronald Reagan in its rhetoric. I love Reagan too, especially for defeating the USSR, but his ultimate legacy, mass amnesty and the end of historic America, is his ultimate legacy, that stuff. I think that is his ultimate legacy in the most profound. I mean, he did other things which have had a long-term impact. I don't want people who love Reagan to say I'm being unfair here, but I think that is certainly the most enduring facet of the Reagan presidency. I don't think that Walter Mondale, by the way, would have been any better. He probably would have been worse in one way or another. But same thing with Jimmy Carter. But I think that I'm very sure that Reagan is immensely overrated by the right. And, you know, I would say Trump, even though some people say I want a Reagan, not a Trump, I would say Trump was 1,000 times better than Reagan. Paul, anything to say about what Dr. Bob brought up?
I agree with your last statement. I infinitely prefer Trump to Reagan. And I really don't see Reagan as having he did up the ante in terms of, you know, arms competition with the Soviet Union. He brought them to their knees, and they were already in an economically precarious position by the time Reagan became president. And I suppose we have to be happy about this. But he was somebody who had a chance to make changes, who didn't make those changes. I was an advisor to his administration, and I was one of the people urging him to get rid of the Department of Education, which he didn't. He made very few changes except hiring some neoconservative decorative types at the top. Most of the Department of Education was full of leftists. Hardly any changes were made in the bureaucracy, the federal bureaucracy, which was then full of leftists and remains, you know, full of even crazier leftists today. For somebody who did so little, you know, saying that that we had a conservative revolution under Reagan, as Steve Hayward says, is I would say hyperbolic, but it's almost like living in a fantasy world. Trump was confrontational. He was abrasive. This, but I mean, the things he confronted have to be confronted. Mm-hmm. You can't be nice. I mean, the media are a dangerous force in the United States. They're kingmakers. They can break or make political leaders. Mm-hmm. They don't tell us the truth. They distort reality most of the time. They hide things. They were responsible largely for Biden's election, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the electronic media decided to censor anybody who was critical of Biden. You know, weeks before the election, when stories were coming out about Hunter Biden and Joe's involvement in Hunter schemes and so forth, they just, you know, censored it. And apparently they were involved. The media bosses or high-tech media and others were invited to a convocation of all these forces that were working against Trump, mm-hmm. including BLM, by the way. Black terrorists were also invited. You know, and Joe's Chamber of Commerce. they're all on the same side, unfortunately, until the Black Lives Matter, you know, blow up the Chamber of Commerce, I suppose. But you know, the Trump at least recognized where the enemy was. In the case of Reagan, I think he was all that sharp. I also found him tiresome just listening to some of his speeches. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he had any impact, you know, on domestic policy. The only impact is that Reagan determined how far to the right we're allowed to go, to be respectable conservatives. And believe me, he didn't go very far to the right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because some people have told me that just like Trump, Ronald Reagan was assailed by the media. But I actually decided to go back and watch some of his press conferences. And the media was not nice toward him, but he basically was very obsequious toward the media. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. really sad. It was sick almost, because this goes to show where the whole ethic of Republicans basically letting the media walk all over them, I believe, came from. Because Nixon was not that way with the media. He was very similar to Trump, where he gave it right back to them. That's why they hated him. But Reagan was, you know, even though he was purportedly more conservative than Nixon, which I really don't agree with, but he basically let the media walk all over him. And it was really the idea of making that guy your hero, I think, is just weird.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I agreed at the time too.
Yeah, it's something else, to say the least. From Douglas Edward, 84, Paul and Joseph, do either of you have any thoughts on Andrej Babiš, the Prime Minister of Czechia? I have found his and his party's ideology hard to pin down when I've looked him up, and the Czech election is next week and is expected to be competitive. I am not intimately, but at least passingly familiar with the politics of the Czech Republic. I almost call it Czechoslovakia because it's just that something that's in your mind, but the Czech Republic. It seems to be that the politics generally popular there, obviously not with everyone, but generally, is a mixture of economic nationalism, particularly of a lefting, not hardcore leftist, but at least a sort of left lean, merged with a very strong cultural conservatism. They like their history, the Czechs. They like their national uniqueness. They are not in favor of demographic replacement, and they want to maintain their essentially national integrity. At the same time, it does go to show you could have a serious form of, and this really is conservatism. It's not Con Inc stuff, but it's a de facto form of conservatism what they have in the Czech Republic. It goes shows you don't need religion to do it, because the Czechs are some of the most secular people on the planet. I mean, you know, a lot of these people never even are probably even most people in the Czech Republic have never even read the Bible. So it's interesting to see how they are able to make all of this work. It's a very syncretic politics, which the Czech Republic has, I think, owing to its highly diverse history. I think that Babiš does certainly deserve re-election. I from what I've seen of him, I have nothing really to criticize. And I think that his party is sort of what I would call a hodgepodge lodge, but that's because the Czech Republic's politics are very much a hodgepodge lodge. But the next elections in the Czech Republic certainly is supposed to be competitive. We'll see what happens. But I don't see them veering toward the left, at least not the woke left. Certainly, I think the economic left will not, you know, be forgotten. I don't think they're going to have some sort of Reaganite neoliberal revolution. But I think that the Czech Republic will... I just don't see things changing there in a woke direction. Paul, anything to say about what Douglas Edward brought up?
Yeah, this is a point I'm always making. I may be belaboring this point, but I'll make it once again. That if you look at the European continent, words like liberal and conservative economic policy, as we use them in the United States, don't really apply because the nationalist right there is in favor of, you know, a largely state-controlled economy. You know, welfare states and right-wing nationalist states in Europe go together. So we really can apply an American Republican model to what's going on in the Czech Republic. What I find interesting is that the Czechs were the favorite country in East Central Europe of the liberal establishment. They've always liked the Czechs because they were liberal. And, you know, almost half the Czechs voted communist after the Second World War.
Yes.
You know, they almost welcomed the Soviets, the Soviet-type government. And, you know, I remember even in graduate school, Czechs were always heroes. Hungarians were disliked. Poles were disliked. Germans were absolutely loathed. Mm-hmm. And for all the wrong reasons, of course. There is reason to loathe them today. But half the reason they were disliked back then. But the Czechs have always received a very good press. Hungarians, no, not so much. So the Czechs can be like Orban, and they still are not going to be attacked because they're seen, you know, as a Western progressive people. And then, as Joseph mentioned, they don't come at you and say we're a Christian nation. Mm-hmm. They are Christian, I suppose, in some sense, because they're nationalists. And if you remember, Jan Hus was the father of both the Protestant Reformation and Czech nation, you know. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like Luther in Germany, who, you know, was a religious leader, but also a national leader in some sense. He created the modern German language, German literary language, and so forth. So, the Czechs are patriotic in that sense. I mean, that they, you know, national churches, national shrines, national religious leaders. But, they're not going to go out of their way to say they're a Christian nation. And you're right. I mean, they've been largely a secular country for a long time. This is not different from East Germany, which is the Lutheran part of Germany, but which is very, very secularized, but which also votes the furthest to the right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the churches in Germany are thoroughly leftist churches, including the Catholic Church, thoroughly leftist. So, you know, the secularists in East Germany don't live, aren't going to, you know, converting to Christianity or Lutheranism is not a step, you know, toward the right for them. But I think applies to the Czech Republic. So they can get away with being on the right, and they are a nationalist country that sort of pride themselves on their national antiquities. The Slovaks traditionally have been seen as the more conservative of the two people. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether their government is more conservative now. They're not doing quite as well economically, but then they never were in Slovakia. I think that probably the Czech Republic is going to remain whatever it is, even after the next election.
Agreed. And from Jonathan, the German elections were fascinating. The SPD won out over the CDU and will form an almost unworkable coalition between the Greens, who are Marxist neocons, essentially, and the FDP, who are the only major German party other than AfD that's genuinely pro-middle and working class. They're basically the Democrat Party from 30 or 40 years, in the sense they favor government protecting small business from big business, and they viciously despise the Greens. So a coalition between the two with the SPD is weird, to say the least. Mathematically and ideologically, a center-right coalition between the CDU, FDP, and AfD makes the most sense, though Merkel has done everything in her power to prevent that from happening. Very, very good stuff you brought up, Jonathan. You're very correct, I think, about Merkel, what she's done. Also, the bizarre situation in Germany, as you relay it, is just that bizarre. But Germany's a bizarre country, so I've come to expect the weirdest of the weird from it, and this certainly qualifies. Fascinating indeed. I can't say I'm sorry to see the CDU out of power. They certainly did nothing to deserve staying in power. But unfortunately, the dominating forces in the new governing coalition, unstable as it is, as Jonathan describes, is nothing to write home about in any positive sense. I think it will even, certainly they'll be even nuttier than the CDU was. And the CDU might decide to move leftward to keep up where with where it perceives the German public to be. Paul, anything to say about what Jonathan brought up?
Yeah, I would say that the Germans fully deserve the government that they have, and I hope they suffer grievously under it. I have absolutely no sympathy for these people. In fact, I loathe them. They vote for parties that don't hide their absolute hatred for the German people, that attack normal families, that attack traditional religious institutions, traditional community, wants to open the floodgates to Islamic immigration to the country, attacks every inherited Christian or Judeo-Christian institution the country has ever had, and spits at its entire national past. These are the party for which the Germans vote. Sergei Trifkevich wrote a piece for Chronicles. He's our European editor, deals mostly with foreign policy. And I think he described Die Grünen as a party of absolute lunatics, of a kind that, you know, you see only, I suppose, in insane asylums or maybe, in Washington. They're absolutely crazy. Now, they could form an entire leftist alliance. I'm thinking of this. They could have Die Grünen, Die Sozialdemokraten, which are not social democrats anymore. They're just lunatic woke leftists, basically. And there's also the party, what is it called? The other one, Die Partei der Demokratischen Linken or something, the party of the
what
left.
What's the abbreviation? I'm trying to think of it, but no, you're right. I know what you're talking about. Please go ahead.
Right, right. Yeah, the party of the Democratic Left, which are basically the old SAD. They were the East German communist cadre that now run the, and they would be the most, perhaps, you know, if they were simply East German communists, they'd be the most stabilizing and the sanest influence on that government. Mm-hmm. But even they've become woke, extremely woke. So it's simply a crazy government. And I do have friends in Germany who are nice people, and they vote for the AfD. Die Freie Demokraten are hardly anything. I mean, they're just they're a party that exists for those who are too cowardly to vote for the AfD. Even though they're sitting inside of an election booth, I'm thinking half in German here. But you know, they go die Wahlkabine, das war da sitzen sie, das war they're in their booth and they have to vote. You know, they're sitting there and they cannot bring themselves to vote for the AfD, which is simply what the Merkel Christian Democrat, they were this Christian Democrats before Merkel took over. They were the Christian Democrats under Kohl. They're not a neo-Nazi. They're not even a particularly far-right-wing party. Die Freie Demokraten will go along with anybody as long. In fact, there's no reason for it to even exist. They came into existence as a North German Protestant party after the Second World War for people who would vote for the CDU. They were seen as because the CDU came out of the Zentrumspartei, the Catholic Center Party, and Die Freie Demokraten were Protestants. They wouldn't vote for the although Merkel and a lot of other leaders of the CDU have been Protestants, but they wouldn't vote. So they voted for Die Freie Demokraten, and they were slightly more pro free enterprise, I suppose. Now it's sort of hard to tell them apart. It's hard to tell the CDU from the Social Democrats. The only difference I can see is if you're a Catholic, you might vote CDU. If you were Protestant, you might be more likely to vote for SPD. I mean, that's about the only difference. I really don't see any difference. I mean, the Christian Democrats under Merkel have become as woke and as leftist as the SDP. I also don't think Merkel is necessarily over. I mean, she's always, going to retire. She's going to leave. But although she destroyed her party, she has remained relatively popular. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the that came to her and asked her to form another government.
I wouldn't be surprised either, by the way. Go ahead.
I think it's entirely possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she really has no loyalty to any party. She's destroyed her own party. Mm-hmm. You know, and she simply is the local representative of the woke left, you know, establishment and corporate capitalist establishment. She is the establishment. And she's very popular among the American media. Mm-hmm. And the Germans have a desperate desire to be accepted, that we shouldn't think of them as Nazis anymore. And, you know, Merkel is well-liked. She's considered to be a very stable, judicious conservative on Fox News. Uh-huh. She is about as conservative as I'm woke, I suppose. but from their standpoint, she's conservative. So she does have a good international standing, and the Germans love that stuff. Because mm-hmm. They're trying, you know, they were re-educated. They're trying to rehabilitate themselves. So I wouldn't be surprised if she stayed on. The other candidates are so terrible. I can't imagine them becoming chancellors for very long. I mean, like Arnim Laschet, who seems to be a low-grade moron, who's been her competitor in the CDU. Then there's this very attractive woman, Baerbock, who is, was it Anneliese or Annemarie? Das war Baerbock from the Grünen. She's a very pretty woman. I've listened to her interviewed, and she has the intelligence of a sea scallop. So I don't think she's going to go very far. So I would not be surprised if Merkel made a comeback.
Question, Paul, who would you vote for? Erich Honecker or Angela Merkel?
Oh, Honecker.
I was going to say.
Oh, I much prefer the communists to the CDU. But they're more conservative.
I was going to say. But he is today lambasted as a vile chauvinist who opposed human rights. That doesn't dissuade you from supporting him?
Oh, no. Absolutely not.
No, I think that I've received criticism for this, but I think that the fall of the Soviet Union was something which had very negative impacts.
Yes, it did. It did, because the real crazies took over, whereas mm-hmm. the communists sort of kept them in line. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely so. Yeah, it's a terrible shame to see what's happened. I will just say quickly, you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment from Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs as soon as you can. Get it in there as soon as possible, because the show won't go on tonight as long as some others have. You know, I think that I don't know that the AFD has a real future. I think that its support is very limited. I can't see it ever forming a government.
No. No, they also seem to be going down. It's very hard to maintain a party structure and membership if anyone who joins your party is going to lose his job. Mm-hmm. You know, and if your headquarters are being bombed by these anti-fascist Nazis, you know, and the police just stand by and they smile and say, well, you know, these are neo-Nazis who I want to meet. I mean, they're also not really very far on the right. Mm-hmm. But what has happened is that the German media, with the help from Merkel, has turned anyone who is not on the left into a Nazi. You know, as the Germans say, "Und das war alle Partei, das war die nicht, das war linksstehend, das war Welten, das war angebräunt." That, you know, they make it brown like the Nazis, any party that's not on the left. And that's exactly what's happening there. The Freie Demokraten, they leave them alone because they're nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just like window dressing. They're not going to affect anything. The AfD, I doubt the AfD would even do very much at this point, but they need some Nazi enemy to strike at. And I mean, the CDU, until Merkel took over, was probably as far to the right as the AfD. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, Paul. Do you think that Merkel has any sort of serious political belief system? Some have said she's just a pragmatist. Others have said she's a liberal conservative. Some have said she's just a hardcore leftist, like a crypto communist. What do you think her views actually are, if she even has any?
I don't think she has any views. I think she's a total cynic. And, you know, she was a communist member who even worked for the Stasi for a while. Then when the Berlin Wall was falling, she was a Christian Democrat,
yeah.
But those parties don't really mean very much. They are the Germans have an expression, die Blockflötenpartei, and which really means sort of like fellow traveling parties. And the Christian Democrats in East Germany were basically a Blockflötenpartei of the SED, that were the Communist Party, and they were just kept around. And then, you know, then she says, here I am, I'm a Christian. And she ends up taking over. And another one in this Blockflötenpartei who took over was a man named Maziel, who was also, I think, a communist for a long time. Was Maziel, I think, is the way the name is pronounced in German, Maziel. He ended up taking over. He was a high ranking Christian Democrat in the West as well. I also, a friend of mine in Germany sent me a picture of Merkel standing next to Axel Springer's fourth wife. Remember the Springer Verlag? They were sort of conservative at one time. They were very conservative. And she was sort of being associated with them. And it didn't surprise me, you know. I mean, she really has no convictions, you know. And then to get in good with the left, she had an open border, so that, you know, 1.5 million migrants, untested, as they were allowed to just come into Germany. And she's always talking about the evil German past and atoning for it. She makes all the right noises. Some of these Germans are so tiresome. There's a man named Steinmeier, who's now president. Everything he talks about is how bad Germany was before the left took over. It's like one tragic picture from, I don't know, the fall of the Roman Empire until the leftist takeover or something of Germany. Merkel will make all the same sorts of noises, you know, about how bad we used to be, and now we're atoning, and we're sinful, we're conscious of our sins as a people, and therefore we have to set a special example of being anti-nationalist, being against Germany. And, you know, we're going to be part of a world organization. We'll cease to be Germans. And we're going to open borders. We'll let everybody in, because this is how we atone for Hitler. And you listen to these people. They're tiresome. I mean, they all sound like even worse than Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, they're mainstream Germans. I mean, Germans like listening to this stuff, I suppose, to each his own. And, you know, if you engage in collective masochism as a nation, I suppose, you know, you like these people. But I can't determine anything that Merkel. Our parents are communist, who went to live under the communists. Her father was a Lutheran minister who decided that, you know, the Germans are a sinful nation who must atone for the Nazis. And his atonement was living under the communists. Now, Merkel grew up under the communists and seems to, you know, have been loyal. She was a loyal communist. She was staatstreu. She was loyal to the state. And then at some point she decided the state was not going to last. So she sort of changed sides.
Yeah, I think that about sums it up. By the way, folks, this is not the last call, but it is the call before the last call. If you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs and leave it as soon as you can. Thank you very much in advance. Not the last call, but the call before the last call. Get your stuff in as soon as possible. Thank you very much in advance. Paul, moving back toward the home front, we were discussing Confederate Jews and how Robert E. Lee was very much favored by them. And it's interesting because today, of course, Lee's statues are being taken down all over the South. And this is obviously being done as a means of atoning, speaking of atonement, for the past. So please explain, I suppose, what you were telling me about Southern Jewry and the Civil War. I think it's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, they were, at least initially, Sephardic Jews, then some German Jews joined them. And the Jews who participated in the Confederate forces, and they all volunteered, by the way, were disproportionate to their numbers. I mean, there were about 25,000 Jews living in the South in 1860. Over 2,000 served as Confederate soldiers. Robert E. Lee was actually almost a kind of patron to the Jews. I mean, he sent them home for Jewish holidays and this, whereas the Union side was not very nice to Jews. And in fact, we know General Grant, in December of 1862, issued an order to kick all Jews out of Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, and probably a few other states, because he said, you know, they're all black marketeers. And I've been listening to these defenses of Grant that, so I said, you know, he really didn't be meant. What he meant was, you know, black marketeers. What he was saying was all Jews are black. So Lincoln did countermand this. He knew it was crazy, to his credit. But, you know, the to pretend that somehow the Union side was the side that supported Jews or Jews is ridiculous. Now, the question is, did Jews own slaves? Of course they did. And you have to also remember that Sephardim, in many cases, came from the West Indies, like Judah Benjamin's parents came from the Virgin Islands, and the Danish Virgin Islands. And of course they owned slaves. So, you know, they were not alienated from the Southern practice of having slaves, you know. But then the German Jews who came were equally pro-Confederate. And even after the South loses the Civil War, the Jewish congregations in the South, many of which reform, reformed by the standards of the time, of course, you know, would celebrate every Confederate holiday, would have statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson within the synagogue, and even in the Jewish cemeteries, instead of a special place for people who fought for the cause. To say that, you know, Jews in the South despised the Southern cause because, you know, Bernie Sanders or Ruth Bader Ginsburg wouldn't like it is ridiculous. But the thing that I always point to is that the Sephardic settlement in the South is not really anything that, you know, it's not like the later Eastern European Jewish settlement in the United States. It's much smaller numbers, and they assimilate very rapidly, you know, and they do not self-segregate, and they do not dislike Gentiles as anti-Semites. Remember, these people had been kicked out of Spain or these other places centuries before, and many of them had lived in the West Indies, like Joseph's ancestors, right? And where they were on plantations and stuff like that. So they were not at all alienated from Southern life. When they came, they were able to fit into it very quickly. Even though many of them were merchants living in places like Mobile and New Orleans and Charleston and so forth, they also bought plantations. You know, I think Judah Benjamin's parents were basically merchants. He had a plantation. So, you know, they did go from one stage to the next. Anyhow, I do have some kind of, I must have been a television program discussing these things. I find most of these people extremely charming. I like them. You know, this is not like discussing the Jews in the contemporary Democratic Party or anything like that. The Jews on the woke left. These are much more interesting people. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I like the Sephardic immigration to the United States. It's sort of hard to be neutral because I think these people are in some ways lovable.
It certainly is an interesting story, the story of Jews in the American South. None of my ancestors were Southern Jews, but many were Sephardic Jews in the Caribbean. So obviously this is a story that I find very personally relatable. And I'm always glad to hear about it. As a matter of fact, there is a county here in Florida named Levy County after one of the state's first U.S. senators, and he was a Jew from the Caribbean, although he converted, I believe, to Presbyterianism. So that's always interesting. But it's very, very interesting, of course, Southern and Confederate Jewish history.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we should take note of is that most of these Jews disappear because they become Presbyterians or Episcopalians in a few generations. So the Jews who self-segregate and become extreme Orthodox, remains extreme Orthodox, or become social radicals, do survive much longer as a community. It's like, you know, someone's telling me about the Mordechai family in Raleigh, North Carolina. My friend Boyd Cathy is this guy. And he says, you know, they were originally Jews, and they became Episcopalians. They were, you know, they were sort of pillars of Southern society. And, of course, they supported the Confederacy. But, you know, they ceased being Jews after about, I suppose, one or two generations.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously if you have Jewish ancestry, depending on the Jewish religious movement, you're always considered to be Jewish. But no, the loss of Jewish identity is a very real thing because of assimilation. And it happens quite a lot. You know, it's interesting because the left now is really pushing this. I do read Jewish publications from a left-wing point of view just to see what's going on. And they're very big now on Jewish intermarriage with Muslims. And they very frequently encourage it overall. There has been an interesting shift in the American Jewish community. There has been toward assimilation. And eventually what it means almost certainly is the lack of Jewish continuity, which is to say the continuity of Jewish identity.
Yeah, I take it that you prefer somebody marrying into the first families of the South as opposed to Muslim immigrants.
Yes. Oh, but of course, yes, there's no question about that. But anyway, this is now the last call. If you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please leave it via Streamlabs and leave it as soon as you can, because this is the last call. You have been warned. The last call is here. Get your stuff in ASAP. So anyway, Paul, as we do wind things down tonight, unfortunately, because it's been such a great conversation, I do think that American politics in the long run are destined to be controlled by the left because of their demographics. Texas is an especially interesting situation because there, even though the GOP is doing better with Tejanos, who are Texans of Mexican background, their families have been there for quite a while, it's doing much, much worse with suburbanites, generally speaking, most of whom are native Texans and a great deal of whom are white. And once Texas goes to the Democrats in a presidential race, it's basically over for the GOP, not in congressional races, but in presidential elections. And Abbott, even though I'm not a big fan of public polling, Abbott is now rather unpopular, no surprise. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in Texas during the years to come. I think that it will go for the Republicans in 2024, but I'm skeptical about 2028 onward.
Yeah, no, I think you have reason to be skeptical. I mean, as horrible as Biden is, and all, you know, and as horrible as all the screw ups have been under Biden, you know, if you look at these polls, he still has like 44-45% popularity or something. My question is, who at this point could consider him to be anything other than a demented wash up? But the Democrats have holding power, you know. And if you notice, Trump's support went well below that.
Of course.
And we say, you know, he's deep underwater, Biden. Well, he's deep underwater with the numbers that Trump usually had. So, you know, and I look at something like 64% of the Americans polled support the mandates. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't believe that. I mean, they're wrecking destruction or havoc everywhere. They're depopulating hospital staff and so, but people want the government to control them on this COVID thing. Even if what they tell them is nonsense, they contradict themselves. They want control, so that, you know, if DeSantis says you're free to choose, they don't want to be free to choose. They want to be controlled. And I think this is something the Democrats understand. It's sort of like Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor. The Grand Inquisitor is right that, you know, don't give people the bread of freedom. They want the other bread, and they want to be controlled. And they want it to be. And the Democrats are very good because the Democrats are totalitarian. They're very good at this. Mm-hmm. You know, they also screw up. They cover the country with crime and illegals and this, and they're COVID carrying illegals so they can get more Democratic voters into the country. But the people who support them stand by them. Mm-hmm. They absolutely stand by them because they are already radicalized. you know, and they're delighted. If the country becomes, you know, Honduras North, plus political correctness, they'll be delighted. They, you know, this is not something the left is concerned about at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the businesses fail, they'll always find a narrative that can explain it in such a way as to show that the left is correct, mm-hmm. and that somehow it's Trump who did this or somebody on the right. So, I think one has to be impressed by the solidarity, the size and solidarity of the left.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, two things. Number one, the Tammy Wynette song, Stand By Your Man, comes to mind because, as you said, the Democrats stand by their party, and they stand by their party just as much as the woman Tammy Wynette was singing about in her song. They
right.
really do.
Right.
there's no question about that. The party mm-hmm. loyalty is quite something else. And you have your Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema, but among Democratic voters, by and large, they do have the stand by your man mm-hmm. mentality when it comes to the Democratic brand. You know, beyond that, I would say that it's interesting because the Democrats do things typically which rally their base, no matter how hateful, vitriolic, or intellectually dishonest it is in and of itself. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at Texas specifically, because that's where the conversation's about, after all, Abbott going through with, you know, some bizarre stuff like making adult prostitution a felony, or, you know, the anti-abortion law, or not allowing young adults to strip in clubs. This stuff is not popular even with a lot of Republicans. So it's almost like he's trying not only to make himself unpopular with the general population, but also his own party. Even the constitutional carry bill, which he signed, is quite unpopular among most Texans, if opinion polls are to be believed, and I generally don't believe in them, but I don't think they're off by more than 15 points, and it's that unpopular what he's doing. Anything to say about that, Paul, before we get to
obviously, as somebody on the right, I'm not offended by what necessarily by what he's doing. I think he has other problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think these are diversionary moves to, you know, to strengthen his base. He's constantly being attacked for not dealing well with the COVID problem. Mm-hmm. He may also be suffering from the illegals coming in. He's not doing enough. Mm-hmm. He's not doing enough for his base, mm-hmm. Which is not the same base as the one that Biden has, which is delighted to have the country overrun by illegals carrying COVID. You know, as long as they infect those rich fundamentalist Republicans or something. I think that Abbott may in the end get hit for not doing enough. Like, you know, he's not done enough with the state national National Guard, or he has not done enough at the border. And he is vulnerable in a way that Biden is not. Mm-hmm. Because Biden is doing something obvious. He's filling the country with Democrats.
Oh, absolutely.
And the Democrat, and he's also making the country less white, and his base loves that. Mm-hmm. But Abbott is, if Abbott fails, he's being incompetent. There also are scandals that are being to surround Abbott, and I'm not sure how he's going to deal with those. I thought he was sort of like insolid, but I think Joseph is right. I think his poll numbers are going down.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because DeSantis has profited handsomely from what he's done, but Abbott has not. And to that, some people would say, how can this be? To that, I say Florida and Texas are very different states, politically speaking, and what works in one is not necessarily going to work in the other. On that note, the last stuff here on Streamlabs for us from C. Kevin Crow. Thoughts on Ryan Dawson. I dislike his tone at times, but given his near total cancellation, try to be understanding. His work on Epstein, the Civil War, bad 9/11 theories, and Israeli influence on 9/11 is well argued. I don't see anti-Semitism or racism. I never really followed Ryan Dawson, to be honest. Kevin, I've heard of him, but I've never really looked into what he said enough to have any sort of solid opinion on the guy. That being said, I've not heard of him going around saying, you know, crazy things about groups or making sort of, you know, wild incendiary statements about group-based motivations. So I think that if he was doing anything really out there, I would have heard of him by now. So I don't really have much to say about him, but that's pretty much it. So I certainly, you know, if I saw him walking down the street one day, I certainly wouldn't, you know, cringe or walk in the other direction or anything like that. Paul, anything to say about Ryan Dawson?
Who is this person? I don't even know who he is.
He's a commentator on what he perceives to be foreign influence on certain things. I believe he lives in Korea or Japan, one of the two. so that's the question. I wish I could have done it more justice, Kevin, and same obviously for Paul, but that's the take there.
Yeah, I don't even know who he is. So, you know, I will not presume to judge him favorably or unfavorably. Mm-hmm.
And from Jonathan, I'd hold off on declaring Texas on the path to being a blue state. It's in a state, no pun intended, of chaos. Recent Quinnipiac poll is the worst, which is the worst poll, has Biden's job approval at 32% in Texas, disapproval at 60%. Even college-educated white voters Biden is underwater with by almost 30 points. After 2024, we can speculate about its political fate, but I wouldn't be surprised if it moves right from 2020 with rightward Hispanic shifts and WCEVs going back GOP to an extent. That's white college-educated voters, for people who don't know. I do see where Jonathan is coming from, and it's a valid perspective, and I despise Quinnipiac as well. It's a terrible poll, but my take on Abbott comes from stuff beyond the Quinnipiac poll. I think that Texas is just undergoing a state of transition, and I would be shocked to see the white college-educated voters in Dallas-Fort Worth and Austin move GOP at all, regardless of who's on the GOP ticket during the years ahead. There is the Tejano vote shifting toward the GOP in a very massive way, which is obviously good for the Texas Republicans, but the Tejanos are outnumbered by this, not just white, but other whites and minorities who are not Tejanos in these suburban and urban areas of Texas, particularly DFW and Austin, greater Austin, if one's talking about the suburbs as well. But duly noted all the same what you brought about, Jonathan. But I'll just say before Paul comments on anything that you said, I think that the fact that Texas did go Republican by these bizarre double-digit margins in 2004, and now it's only going Republican by 6 points in presidential races, it does go to show where the state is headed. Paul, anything to say about what Jonathan brought up?
Yeah, I agree with Jonathan. I think Texas is safely in the Republican column. Biden is absolutely hated. Hispanics are one of the groups that hate him the most in Texas. He has only 30-something percent approval among them. I don't think the Democrats will do well there, even with these, you know, suburban soccer moms and so forth, who have already shown their hand. I mean, they've already voted Democratic on a number of occasions. But I think the factor of change here, or the variable, is the Hispanic vote, which I think is going to move decidedly to the right. It also, I suppose, depends on the black vote, which we can assume is like 90-something percent Democratic, no matter what. And if you look at the Democratic black vote in Texas, I mean, they vote for Sheila Jackson in Houston. I mean, some of these candidates are insane that they vote for. And of course, you know, all they do, these people do, is attack whites all day and, you know, advance critical race theory and so forth. But I think Texas is going to stay Republican for a while. The place that concerns me is Virginia. I really wonder whether Virginia is ever movable. You look at Biden's poll numbers there, and he's not far underwater in the state. I mean, he has like, I don't know, something like 50-49 or something, approval, disapproval. And, you know, if we were living in a normal world, this man who's, what's his name, Youngkin, or the one who's
Glenn
running,
Youngkin,
yeah, he would absolutely trounce this absolute lying hack, McAuliffe, who was the bag man for the Clinton family. The fact that McAuliffe can lead Youngkin by 2 or 3 points is absolutely shocks me. I mean, I could sort of understand this in California. I thought Virginia was a lot better. But I think, and another state which may be immovable at this point, and here I agree with Joseph, is Georgia. I would be very surprised if, what's his name, Herschel, is
Walker,
it
Herschel
Herschel
Walker.
Walker, the football player, manages to win anything in Georgia. I think he's running in the senatorial race. Vernon Jones, is he running in? I think he's in the gubernatorial
Yes.
race.
Yeah, running against Brian Kemp.
The Anti-Defamation League has so far come out and attacked Vernon Jones as a white supremacist or something. Really? So, I mean, that's what you expect.
Craziness. And from, let me see here. I think this is the second to last one, if it ever comes up. Here it is. From Jonathan. Last thing on German elections. Die Linke almost collapsed in its vote share and a number of seats in the Bundestag. Wouldn't be surprised if it fades into obscurity, with much of its traditional voters going to the SPD or Greens. Interesting, Jonathan. I don't have much to say about it, but an interesting perspective. Paul, anything to say about what Jonathan brought up?
Which party is fading away?
Die Link or Die Linke. A
Oh,
D I.
die Linke,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Die Partei der Linken, or die, what is it, die Demokratischen Linken. Yeah, they're disappearing. They're just like, and the reason that I said before they might want to form a coalition with them, but they're disappearing so fast it would probably be useless. I mean, they're just going to other leftist parties. And sort of the first generation were mostly SED cadre, people who were working for the communists. Then they became sort of like, extreme woke leftists, but the Grünen sort of cover all those bases. So there's no reason anymore for the party of the left.
And the last thing here is from C. Kevin Crow, presuming that the page comes up again, which I hope that it will. It's got to come up again. Here it is. UVA poll just showed 52% of Trump voters and 41% of Biden voters said, quote, they said the quote, situation is such that I would vote that I would favor blue slash red states seceding from the union to form their own separate country. Does this surprise you? What are possible, if unlikely, scenarios? I don't think there will be any sort of secessionist movement. I think there's far too much to be gained economically for some very powerful people in the public and the private sector by keeping America together. What keeps America together is certainly not a national culture. It's not a sense of patriotism. It's not a core of nationwide identity. It's the immense value of the American domestic marketplace. It's the same thing that keeps the EU together, the common market there. The US and the EU are very similar at this point. So I don't expect to see any sort of secession coming up. If it were to happen, I think that it would be something which is agreed upon by both ends of the political spectrum, and it would happen legally. But I don't see it coming up. I just think that there's way too much money in keeping the country together. But the poll, even though I don't take public polling very seriously, generally speaking, it is interesting. The numbers do surprise me that so many Biden voters are there. It does not surprise me about Trump voters, however. Paul, anything to say about what Kevin brought up?
It's demographically impossible because these populations are so intermingled by now that I don't know how you would do it. I mean, I live in a very, very conservative interstitial area between Lancaster and Harrisburg, both of which are about as blue as Harlem or, North Philadelphia or something like that. And then of course I have neighbors. I suppose they can move to Lancaster. They don't, but they would probably would be scared to do it, or to Harrisburg. They really don't want to be with their own kind. There are people who vote the same, have the same ideological positions. But it's sort of hard to disentangle these regions. Now, in 1861, it actually makes sense because you have this block of states, 11, 12, 13, depending on how many could get away. They all decided to form, a separate union. Now what we have to go sort of almost house by house in some areas. The other thing is there's no way the left will let this happen. That the left controls everything. They control the military, They control the deep state. They control the media. They're not gonna let half the people go. You know, they want to control everybody. It's like Stalin let Georgia, you know, or some other Ukraine leave the Soviet Union. Of course not. Mm-hmm. I see no way this is going to happen as long as the left has this kind of power. And they are in a position where they can crush their opposition some, you know, unless they're held back. And they're working now successfully to create a one-party dictatorship. Mm-hmm. So, things, why would they ever want to separate or ever allow these neo-Nazi white supremacists to separate from them? And they remember, they control all the force right now. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you know, unless, you know, the army units that defect or something like that, it's almost a kind of fantasy. Mm-hmm. So it cannot happen because of the enormous power wielded by the left.
And ladies and gentlemen, on that note, this concludes tonight's show. We went a bit over, but not too much. Paul, I hope you did enjoy tonight's broadcast.
Yeah, yes, I did. I thought some of the questions were very stimulating, and I apologize for not knowing who that gentleman was who lives in Japan and talks about conspiracies.
Well, it's very good that we're able to have a conversation. I did enjoy it myself, and I do wish to thank everyone for tuning in. You obviously made this conversation what it was, so thank you very much for that. And I hope that everyone has a good weekend, and I hope everyone is subscribed to Cato Gottfried on Rumble. Obviously, that's where the video uploads are made now, so do subscribe there if you've not done so already, because YouTube censorship really is getting crazy, even crazier than it already was, and it was batshit insane. So I'm just throwing that out there. That is it. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next time. Before we go, though, if you liked this episode and you want to support the show, please consider donating to it by clicking on the PayPal link in the description below. Paul and I appreciate your generosity very much. Also, be sure to check out my new book, Runaway Masters, A True Story of Slavery, Freedom, Triumph, and Tragedy, on Amazon. It's a nonfiction book, but I wrote it to read like what I hope is an epic novel, so I hope you do check it out. Thank you very much in advance. Paul liked it, and that to me is one of the highest compliments which the book could be paid. It really is. But anyway, so everybody, take good care, and I wish there was some stuff in the glass, but cheers.